This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about divorce as a factor in mental health and getting the opportunity to dispel a lot of myths around the divorce process, the people that you have involved. And I, for one, learned so much from today's guest, Gillian Jones, who is a certified divorce financial analyst. And so in my way, as an outsider to this industry, I would describe her role as being the person that plans how best your finances can exist after the divorce and what you can do to make that a reality. You know, plan for it, work with your legal advisor to make that a reality. And in doing so, she's a big supporter of getting not just, you know, the financial support from herself in addition to the legal elements, but also how important the emotional support is as well in terms of working with a mental health therapist. And so our perspectives I knew would come together in a lot of ways on this stuff, even though, you know, I have no problem admitting the episode. Divorce is not really something I understand hugely. I've not had a need to look into it before literally researching for this episode. And yet I went away from this conversation feeling so much clearer on it. So I hope wherever you are in your relationship life, there will be things you take away from this episode, not only around divorce, but also the conversations we have around certain challenges she's experienced with her mental health that inform her work now and, you know, her prioritizing of mental health support within, you know, what she recommends to clients. But also we get into conversations around, you know, what different types of abuse can look like in a relationship and ways in which, you know, having information like this can be so empowering in what is a complicated and scary process, at least from my perspective, and I'm not even married. And so we're so glad to have this conversation with Gillian. She is one of my new favourite people. We had a great chat after we just wrapped recording there. And she also told me that quite a few things that she mentions pretty early on in terms of struggles with her own mental health, she was sharing for the first time. And we got to have a little bit of a chat off air about the power of having these conversations that are often not had. And this is a big part of what drives me working so hard on this show week in, week out, even when, you know, things have been changing recently. And sometimes we focus in on certain topics and sometimes they get mentioned. But either way, I think there's so much normalization that can be done by talking about what happens in people's lives, how common certain experiences are, and being as truthful as we can. You know, divorce is very common, but also a lot of the reasons for divorce are more common than maybe we know, because perhaps people do talk about a different reason why things broke down, or they feel the need to sugarcoat it. And I certainly know for me, I like to know what's going on for the people in my life. And I find it incredibly grounding to hear the behind the scenes of other people's lives, when so often we can look from the outside and think, oh, it's chaos at times in my life, and yet everyone else can seem to have it together. And seemingly a lot of them think I have it all together, and I will take that as the inaccurate flattery that I know it can be. And with all that said, we'll get into this interview with Gillian Jones in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. Talking mental health is such a passion of mine, but we also know there's an array of physical symptoms that can indicate we should be speaking up in order to access support. For me, that can be unexplained exhaustion and aches, but other examples can be disrupted sleep, changes in appetite, migraines, so many more. Whatever is causing you stress, it might be time to speak to someone. And as you'll hear us talk about often, including in this very episode, therapy can be a brilliant option. One of the fastest and most convenient routes to therapy is BetterHelp, partly why you hear so many podcasters talk about it. And when you sign up to their secure platform, you can be matched with a professional counsellor in just 48 hours.
Then you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions alongside their ongoing messaging service to work around your schedule. This can also be a more affordable option, and sliding scale pricing is available where your income is limited. To join over 2 million people who have taken this great step for their mental health, visit betterhelp.com/mentalhealth. Plus, as one of our listeners, you get 10% off the first month just by visiting that link, betterhelp.com/mentalhealth. So be less alone with whatever you're going through by finding your own professional counsellor today.
Hi, my name is Jillian Jones. And one of my earliest experiences that I can remember that stands out with mental health is when I was 13 years old, an interesting and difficult age to begin with. One of my close friends passed away suddenly from a blood clot. And I had a very hard time, as you can probably imagine, being a teenager, dealing with her passing. I was fortunate enough that I'd really never had any family members pass away at that point. I did not fully grasp what death was, other than maybe a hamster passing away. So it was very new on multiple levels. We did come together as a community to have shared experience, to have some shared grieving, but I continued to grieve. For me, the grieving process didn't stop. I was still functioning, being a good student, being a good athlete, being a good friend, but I became very depressed. When I wasn't doing something that I needed to do, I would spend a lot of time in my room on my own, not in a normal way that a teenager goes off into their bedroom on their own, into their own world, but crying and listening to the sad music, but constantly. My mother didn't know what to do. She knew that I was suffering, I guess you could say. So she did get me a mental health therapist. I grew up in a very small town in Western New York. So professionals were limited, as many resources were limited. It's also extremely hard to find a child therapist. Very, very, very hard, let alone in a small town. So I did go to one. I don't remember much of it. I don't remember liking it. I don't remember necessarily disliking it. You know what? I do remember it not being useful. It was a waste of my time. So one of my first experiences was there's pain when there's death. There's not much help for you. Figure it out on your own. They did prescribe me medication. It didn't work. They actually, I'll share this. I ended up shortly after being on the medication, attempting suicide. And they do believe it was because they were getting me off of the medication. One of the side effects is attempting suicide, and it's a medication that's no longer allowed to be prescribed to anyone under the age of 18. They also put me on sleeping pills, which only lasted a couple of weeks because I was hallucinating. I actually remember some of the hallucinations, other ones my mother told me about. So in a nutshell, what I learned from a young age, my first introduction to mental health, was that it's scary, especially when you're trying to get help. And really, that was the opposite of help. That's what I saw it as at that age. As I grew up, I learned more about mental health. I think it's the greatest thing in the world. I think therapists are the greatest thing in the world. I have therapists myself. It's like an oil check every single week. It's wonderful. I could go on for days and days and days about what I've learned over the past few decades, but initially mental health was not for me because I had a bad experience for a while there.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I want to first off pause on what you mentioned about medication, because, you know, on the show, we're always kind of careful with, certainly I always try and be careful of my tone because I never want to sort of like put anyone off a potential option that could help them. But that is something that often does concern me and guests of mine, that the side effects can at times seem worse than what the medication is meant to be helping you with. And whilst not everyone has certain side effects, when you were already in a dark place and then it comes to light that the medication had become part of the problem, you know, even if it was like coming off it and, you know, that potentially being seen as a good step. I can only imagine how that would have confused things further of, oh, I thought I was making progress and now I seem to be at my worst. And this is very much, you know, the non-linear nature of mental health. And sometimes I do wonder about how much of that can we wrap our head around as a child? You know, how much of that does have to be unpicked later on?
Absolutely. And to add to medication and side effects, I'm a big advocate and believer. And for me personally, I do anything and everything that I can with any health aspect, mental health, physical health, spiritual health, whatever it is. Have I exhausted all of my natural resources? Have I tried everything that could naturally help? And sometimes medication, it's just a temporary thing that you need. Other people are very big on medication. That's fine. We're all allowed to have different tools in our toolbox is what I like to call what I do. What are all my different tools? And sometimes I'm using a different one depending on what situation I'm going through.
You're so right. I think that's something that I think is so important, that each of us should feel empowered to make our own choices and to have, you know, the options that they aren't always there, different mental health options. But I'm so glad that you've got to a place where you've found what works for you more so now. And I'm very much in the same boat. Love therapy. I've been with my counsellor for 4 years, very fond of her. And if anything, you know, she's such a normalised part of my life now that sometimes I even kind of catch myself around someone new and they'll ask me about my day and I'll be like, oh, I spoke to this friend about this thing and this thing. I talked to my counselor about this thing and this thing. And you see their eyes widen a little bit. I'm like, oh, you just bring her up. I'm like, yeah, that's,
she's one of the. And I bring my first name. Yeah. Sean, my boyfriend and I are going to have dinner with his mother tonight. And not that Sean doesn't know at this point. Right. But just like, okay, well, remember I have Gabby from 5:30 to 6:30. Did you tell your mom that I have to see her before we go over for dinner and just flowing over and over again.
Yeah. But I think it's important. And I am aware of, you know, oftentimes I am the one person in a friend's life who will mention therapy so openly. And, you know, I think that's it's a nice place to be in. And I'm always, you know, find it a privilege when people then, you know, respond to that and want to talk about, you know, whether it's something maybe for them or how did I find her and things like this. Yeah, it's a nice place to be in. And it's a nice thing to, you know, I think we won't get in. I'm about to go on a tangent, which I'm going to hold back from because we're not on my dating podcast. But I do think at this point, you know, it's such an asset to already be in counselling when it comes to new relationships. And, you know, that to me is sort of the ideal at this point of like, if we all come into this, we already have outside support. Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And of course, on the show, we've talked a lot about relationships as a factor in mental health. And those are often some of our most popular episodes. So do you mind sharing a bit of how your understanding developed of how relationships influence our mental health?
Okay, let's see. How relationships affect our mental health. I'm going immediately to my relationships with men in my adult years. I was a serial dater until my early 30s. And that's when I pretty much did my 5-year hiatus on purpose. Mm-hmm. Got a trauma therapist. Did so many other things, but back to the question, because I love going on tangents. You can wrap me back in whenever you need to.
Cool.
You may need to. I do mean that. In my 20s, I dated a man for 6 years. I would call it a normal relationship. He's a good guy. We ended up getting engaged. We lived together, called off the engagement, split after the 6 years. No big fiasco. Someone cheated on somebody. We were growing separate ways, you could say. Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, we'll say 6 months, I met a man and very quickly it became an unhealthy relationship. I did not know that at the time. I thought that he just really cared about me. He was very interested in me. He wanted to know where I was all the time, who I was with. And you'd say, oh, gosh, well, if he wanted to know all of that, like kind of a stalker, right? Well, he wasn't directly asking me those things. He would say something nice like, oh, I'm thinking of you. What are you up to? Or who are you with? Or it would be formed a completely different way. It wasn't that direct, of course. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be with me all the time, which I thought was sweet, when really it was so he could keep tabs on me. He slowly started pulling me away from my family. It turned into an emotionally abusive relationship after just a few months, which I kind of got was happening, but I also kind of didn't. I didn't want to talk about it with anybody because I had told everybody how in love I was with this man. Actually, everyone, he was very charismatic, very, very charismatic. Everyone loved him. Everyone said, oh my gosh, you should get married. You two are perfect together. But something always felt off. I had very high anxiety with him. I already have anxiety to begin with. Right now it's very well controlled. But yeah, I had high anxiety with him. I was on my toes all the time. To ease that, I would drink with him quite frequently, and that would ease my anxiety. And with he and I, when our highs were high, they were really high. And when our lows were low and we were having a fight, they were really low. It was a roller coaster ride. And my brain responded to that. And it's almost like I liked being on that roller coaster ride for reasons that I didn't know at the time, but I learned later, you know, my brain waiting for that high to come. And when the lows were low, we would just drink instead, I guess you could say. Towards the end of the relationship, he was getting quite jealous, even though I didn't even talk to men anymore, like anybody anymore, because he was so jealous at that point. I was still not talking about it with anybody because I felt stupid that I was with somebody that wasn't treating me well. I didn't understand different forms of abuse. When I thought of abuse, I thought of a man hitting a woman. That's what I thought of. Not that I had never heard emotional abuse, not that I had never heard the word sexual abuse, not that I had never heard financial abuse. Actually, I probably hadn't heard that word at that point. But he wasn't hitting me. So, and he was also gaslighting me. I didn't know what that was. And I think it was before the term was really, it was certainly before it was, I'll just say popular for lack of a better word right now. So I didn't know what gaslighting was. And in the end, it ended with another argument, him flipping over some furniture, throwing me down, hitting me, ripping out a good chunk of my hair. He did leave after that, surprisingly. I called some friends to help. My parents lived hours away. We left the apartment with my dog that I was living in. I found a safe place for the weekend. He was stalking me, trying to find me, calling all my friends in line, trying to figure out where I was. And the relationship stopped. I was in what I call a cloud for quite a few months, not understanding everything that had happened. It took me quite a while to get help. I ended up seeing a regular therapist that I still have. We finally realized I needed some trauma therapy specifically for that relationship and some other things throughout my life. But how it affected my mental health, there's a background and I kind of trickled it in there. To sum up how it affected my mental health, I used alcohol to self-medicate, which was not a good thing. I had the highest forms of anxiety that I've ever had before, which also made it hard to concentrate at work. I questioned myself all the time. I felt a lot of shame. That's why I wouldn't tell anybody. And it still affects me to this day, almost where I won't say need to be, but where I want to be. Mm-hmm. If a man raises his voice at me, even if it's like a man that I trust, I will have a natural reaction that I can't stop, even if it's for a split second, because my brain just goes to, you're in trouble, fight or flight. And it might be a reaction for 10 seconds. It might be a reaction that I have for 5 minutes, but that's still ingrained in me from that relationship. So that is a way that a relationship has negatively affected me and positively affected me. When I started having clients, before I started my divorce business, when I started having clients that were going through a divorce or recently divorced, especially if they were being abused, I remembered that relationship and that man. I remembered how I got away from him. I remember how I didn't even understand that I was being abused. I remembered everything. And I remember that I felt empowered eventually. I didn't feel ashamed anymore. And I wanted them to feel that way. And I did not want them to be controlled anymore. And I wanted to help them get the help that they needed. A lot of times, though, the money part keeps them back. If they don't feel like they can survive on their own, or they don't have at least some for a period of time to get away, they're not going to leave. It's at the base of the hierarchy of needs.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you so much for sharing that. I'm so glad to hear the contrast of, you know, how much shame you felt around that. And a lot of that is, you know, a part of the abuse and very common. And now, you know, how much it is something you talk about so openly. And, you know, I'm sure you are so good at recognizing a lot of the signs in other people, because, you know, I've been there as well in an abusive relationship. And, you know, I didn't know the extent of it. I maybe was aware of 10 to 20% and I was, you know, really unhappy. And yet, you know, I would put that on anything else because she loved me. And I was being told that constantly to justify a lot of the behaviours. And also, yeah, there wasn't the physical abuse, which is what so often is stereotyped. You know, we talk about often the dangers of stereotypes to do with, you know, mental health, people thinking they don't have certain conditions because they don't look like the default model that we might imagine. And, you know, it's the same with a lot of experiences. And I'm also particularly glad with what you shared there about, you know, the links to finances, because that's so often an overlooked part of the abuse, that a core part of gaslighting, a core part of coercive control and other forms of emotional abuse is making this person feel they have no chance of surviving in the world without this person and this specific relationship, and indeed the relationship functioning exactly the way that the other person thinks it should. And if you're not aware of the extent of that, of course you're going to go into meeting a financial professional like yourself with a lot of these biases that can be kind of coerced into you.
Yeah, absolutely. So with the biases that are coerced into you, to begin with, like you were saying, you only were aware of 10 to 20% of the abuse going on. So, you know, with other people, quite similar. On top of that, they're being told all of these things by their spouse, hopefully soon to be ex-spouse, about what's going to happen with the divorce. If you try to leave me and divorce me, this is going to happen. This won't happen. And because they're so used to listening to them or wanting to believe them in certain situations or just petrified, they're going to believe the lies like they have in the past, because they've been taught to do that, what the divorce is going to be like. Or it's so easy to find bad information on divorce. It's like one of the number one topics. I don't know this, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I'm making up the statistic myself. It's one of the number one topics that has bad information on it. So this person, you're not going to get anything. I'm going to make sure that I get the house, a really big one. And I don't get into this arena. This is for the attorney to do, but I need to be very mindful of it. And we still talk about it a bit. It's using the child as a pawn. You're never going to see them. I'm going to have all the money. So they, you know, they won't let you see the child. And that's a really big one. The more abusive the relationship, the more they will try to use the child or children as pawns. Almost all of my clients are women. So I'm going to use a woman as my client in all these discussions. So they're told so often they won't get their husband's 401k. They won't get the house. They won't get the money in the bank account, whatever the asset may be. When in fact, in most states, everything is regulated by the state. It's going to be divided half and half almost all of the time. There's certain situations and certain things that aren't divided in half, but it doesn't matter whose name that it's in. It doesn't matter who earned it. If it occurred during the marriage, it's half and half. However, they come to me thinking that's not the case. And I get to tell them, oh, no. This is what's really going to happen roughly. and this is what your life is going to look like after the divorce. So oftentimes that's enough to get it moving. It's at least enough to go get a consultation with an attorney if they haven't already. Hopefully it's enough to have them get to see a mental health therapist. Although a lot of times, thank goodness, they just started seeing one and that's how they came to meet me. So we can figure out that financial part. How can we survive for a little while we get this going?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And to paint a bit of a picture for the listeners, Zane, would you mind talking through like your role in a divorce, what the attorney does, and then, you know, your view on the importance of a mental health counselor involved in that as well?
Sure. I can do almost all of the divorce for a client, or I can step in and out. So I'm going to describe more so of the whole caboodle. So client comes to me, and one of the first things that we need to do, that you could do with an attorney as well, but it makes more sense to do it with me, is what's called the financial affidavit, sometimes referred to as a statement of net worth. That is a legal document that has to be turned in. It has all of your expenses on it, and it has all of your assets and all of your liabilities on it. The first part, the expenses, we go into more detail than required by the document itself. And that's because we really want to get an idea of what the expenses are right now and what they're going to be like after the divorce. Many times that's done at the very end. I say, no, we're going to do it at the very beginning because it's one of the biggest relievers of anxiety. We at least know the facts. We also know how much we're going to need after the divorce. Instead of let's divide everything, now figure out what we're going to need. If I know what the expenses are, then as we're dividing everything, I can look for different ways that I want to divide assets and liabilities that are going to better suit my clients' expenses. So with that document, I call it the backbone of the divorce. We're going to work off of that for the division of assets and liabilities. We need to collect all of the documents because we want to have proof of everything, especially items that we can't get our hands on. And the other side needs to give that to us. So the mortgage, the bank statements, the credit card statements, the 401ks, the IRAs, the investments accounts, I'm going to give them a checklist to make it easy for them. I'm going to help them or make phone calls with them if we need to do that. Attorney's going to get copies. I'm going to get copies. So once we have all of that together, we make sure it's accurate on the financial affidavit. We make sure we get everything from the other side. Now, this is one of the biases. Well, they're going to hide things. They're not going to give me everything. They're not going to let me have their 401k statement. Well, the attorney's going to say, hey, other attorney, we need the 401k statement. And if there's anything I need, I just tell our attorney to get it for me. I can't actually ask for it. They certainly don't need to give it to me since I'm not an attorney. And they have to provide us with everything. And if they don't, then they will get into trouble. And if they really, really, really won't, they're going to get into trouble. And then a judge is going to sign off on a piece of paper. And we can take that piece of paper and we can go to an investment company and say, hey, the judge is ordering this. And the investment company will say, okay, yeah, no problem, no problem. Wow. Now, that's pretty rare that we need to do that because the other attorney will say, hey, we got to eventually give it to them. So let's not waste our time. But sometimes people like to be silly and be a pain.
Yeah, well, I know that's something that is a big worry for a lot of people of how their ex is going to try and throw their weight around. And, you know, I think there can be assumptions that there is a lot of opportunity to withhold information and withhold decisions and delay. But, you know, my understanding is that's a big part of why the court is involved, because they can make certain decisions essentially on behalf of both of you then to be like, no, one of you is not playing fair. We're going to step in.
Right. And a lot of times we don't have to have a judge involved. It'll just be client, attorney, back and forth, let's settle out of court, even though we might get really close to court. Then it's finally like, oh, okay, we settled all of a sudden, right? But yeah, there definitely is where a judge has to be directly involved. And so then it's, you know, once we have everything that we need, both sides have everything that we need, then we start going back and forth with offers. So, you know, some people think like, oh, everything will be divided down the middle. I mean, yeah, you could divide everything down the middle, but that's a lot more work and usually not best for either person. We might have it where one person keeps the house, but half of that house value belongs to the other person. So we have to make up for it somewhere else. So we do, I just call it a trade-off. And one person keeps a little bit more of the retirement account. But we have to keep in mind that there's taxes associated with a lot of those. So now we have to figure out what the tax effect would be. So it starts getting a lot more detailed with capital gains and taxes and penalties for taking out money before actual retirement age. And that's where I shine more, you could say. And there's a bunch of tricks that you can do where you can bend the law because it's a divorce, so the law changes a little bit. It gets quite intricate. And I can, of course, do spousal support, child support. I can figure out all of those things. Maybe instead of paying someone every month, we do it just a giant lump sum and we don't have to deal with it anymore. I say that rather than an attorney doing it on their own, either I can do it all on my own or we can work together. And I'm going to shine with those taxes, with those creative solutions, because I'm the financial person that has my licenses to do that and my experience. And they're not going to do it. They're not going to get into giving advice on investments and taxes. They're not looking for a malpractice lawsuit, just like I'm not going to get into offering legal advice. But we both should know each other's business quite well because it's so, I mean, it's linked together quite well.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I'm so glad that your job exists, because I think for so many people, money is really scary. And, you know, the pressure of divorce and the size of what that means for you legally is overwhelming. You're combining that with the end of a relationship, which you know, hopefully you signed up to willingly and, you know, with the expectation of this is me, this is my marriage for life. So you've got all of that coming down on you at the same time. And so I know for you, such an important part of it is that your clients are also, you know, wherever possible, getting mental health support as well. And so I think I maybe already know, but at what point do you generally kind of recommend or sort of nudge that maybe to them?
In the complimentary consultation. So from the
very early on. Yeah.
Them. I usually, you know, if they don't volunteer it or put it on their intake form, I require a short form to be filled out. So, you know, we just make better use of our time together. So if you don't mind me asking, are you currently seeing a mental health therapist? And then it either is a yes or a no, and I pivot the conversation from there. But I tell them, and I tell everybody, I'm telling everybody right now, your base divorce team, because you're going to need other professionals, or you may need other professionals, is a certified divorce financial analyst. That's what I am. A mental health therapist, and an attorney. Now, maybe you have a mediator because you're mediating. You're still going to need an attorney. So you have the CDFA, the financial aspect. You have a therapist, the emotional aspect. You have an attorney, the legal aspect. There's a reason why all three of us exist. There's a reason why that's your base, because if you have all three, you're going to be really successful and much healthier when you're getting through your divorce. So I actually wanted to be, the two main things I wanted to be when I was growing up, I wanted to be a psychologist and I wanted to be an attorney. And I ended up in finances, but I feel like the other little part of my job is being an attorney and is being a psychologist. You know, I have to have those ideals. So where was I going with that? Shoot. I just thought it was so funny. It's really not that funny that I wanted to be that growing up.
No, I like that though. You know, this is something that often, you know, comes up in these kind of conversations where it can be so much easier to piece together where you've ended up in your career in hindsight. I know that's certainly, like, if you looked at my CV, it only really makes sense backwards.
Yes. Well, all I do at the end of the day is help people. That's all I do at the end of the day. Yes, I'm dealing with numbers. Yes, I'm dealing with, you know, some taxes and projecting rates of return. And my computer systems do a lot of it. I can't do any of the numbers correctly unless I know what someone needs and I know what someone wants and I know what their wishes are and I know what their dreams are. Mm-hmm. The numbers are kind of useless without that. At least I don't think they're very good. If you're not getting that, I don't think it's very good. So when I am working with somebody I'm going to hold space for them. I am there with them. I am sitting with their emotions during that session. But we can't concentrate on our emotions. There's tears. Sometimes they're happy. Sometimes they're sad. But then we have to get back to work. So that's where I need them seeing a mental health therapist. When it's, this isn't fair. This isn't fair. I don't like it this way. You can say that to me. And I can say, I know. Let's get back to the numbers. It's not going to be exactly like that, but it'll be close, because none of that's going to help us get through a division of assets.
No, of course. And may I ask then, with, you know, your own personal experiences and no doubt a lot of things you relate to with your clients, how have you got used to kind of setting the boundaries of how you can connect with them and understand and offer space for them to air things, but then, you know, still keep your mindset of, okay, but I still need to do my job for them. I'm sure it took a bit of work to kind of get as practiced with that.
Right, exactly. So I'm going to take it as two parts here. So one part, when it's happening, what do I do? The other part, I don't know if you directly asked this, but this is what I got from it, is not taking anything home with me, is what I like to call it. Because I will, when it starts happening, I can start absorbing their emotions and bring them home with me. And I did that for a while, and it was not good for my health. So when it starts happening, I let them talk and cry and voice what they don't think is fair, or voice what happened in the past for a few minutes. Like when it's first coming out, especially, it's part of their story. They want to tell me, and you know what? I want them to tell me too, because it still affects everything overall. When they're sharing some of these things with me for the first time, it is giving me clues that I need about finances. You know how it can be fearful and scary? They're sharing with me a little bit of why it's fearful and scary. So then I know how to do the process as well. It does help me to hear some of this. But when they start going on for more than a few minutes, or especially more so when it keeps getting brought up, that's when, after a moment, I'll say, you know, I'm just going to interrupt for a minute. I know we've talked about this before, and it's really great that I understand it, but I think it'd be best if we table this for right now and you bring it to your therapist and we get back to ABC. I care about you. I want to be here for you, but it's going to be much more financially, you know, make more financial sense for you to do it with your therapist. So sometimes what we'll say, and attorneys will say, is, we hear you and we can listen, but do you want to pay us several hundred dollars an hour? Or do you want to pay your therapist, you know, 20, 25% of that? And then the client kind of chuckles for a second, you know, maybe, and they're like, oh, good point. Because if they really do want us to listen, and we've said that's great, we should get back to work. I want to talk about it with you anyways. I'm never going to cut anyone off. I just want them to be aware.
Yeah, no, I think that's very fair. And I think you were also going to add a bit of the importance of, you know, realizing those boundaries for the client, but then also realizing the boundaries for you.
Right, yeah. And when, I guess I used to listen to it maybe more. A little bit more, at least, like at the very beginning. But, and of course, I relate to them. But yeah, I would say the first 6 months, definitely the first year, while it was happening, you know, while they were telling me the story, while they were telling me the abuse, I could start to feel it. Almost like I was going through it. And I'd shut it down, but then it would come back. You know, I'd think about them at nighttime, and that feeling would come back. So I don't know exactly how I learned to have that not happen. I think a lot of it was practice. I know I talked to my therapist about it. It just doesn't happen anymore. I used some tools. I remember it happening. I don't know how I got to where I am today, but I did, where I can just be there, not absorb it. If I do think about them later that night, which oftentimes I do, I don't have a bad feeling. I have hope.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that makes so much sense with your approach and understanding of, you're there to help people, that even if this wasn't maybe the career you dreamed of as a kid, the energy, the passion towards helping people has remained consistent, even if the specific job title isn't maybe the one you saw coming.
That's a very good description. I like that.
Thank you. And I feel like we've touched on a lot of, you know, the challenges around divorce, a lot of the misconceptions. Whilst I'm not married and this is a different world to me, it's nice to hear that some of the elements of it were not as complicated or as uphill a battle as maybe I, you know, had assumed in certain cases. Could you share, are there any more misconceptions that you find that clients often come in with that can affect them? And would you mind sharing a bit of the what you see of the positive impact of people getting, you know, the financial, the legal and the mental health sides sorted or helped?
Yes. So I'm doing a consultation. Maybe it's the first meeting after the consultation. And they think that because their spouse cheated on them, that they're going to be entitled to more. Pretty much all states, actually, is it all states at this point? Almost all states will just say, I'm not giving legal advice. Almost all states have it where it does not matter why you're getting divorced. It's 50-50. And a lot of people are like, wait a second. Whoa. This person's been cheating on this person for 3 years with the whole entire neighborhood. And it doesn't matter. Now, sometimes things will be taken into consideration, but for the most part, it's going to be divided 50-50. Some of the only things that are going to not be divided 50-50 are an inheritance, and even certain situations that will be divided. You can get money back that's spent on your spouse's paramour for the most part. So I had a case where he took his girlfriend down to the Bahamas and we had a receipt for a $12,000 necklace. So she got reimbursed, you know, like she had a trade-off for that. You know, they were about to start going through divorce. She didn't know that he was doing it. The next part it was something positive.
Yes, we will get on to the positive. I just wanted to pick up on that actually, because I can see how incredibly tough that would be for your clients to imagine all of that, you know, can be at the forefront of their mind of certain things that happened, reasons why they're getting divorced, as on top of, you know, that already being such a traumatic experience to go through all of this, divorce in general, to feel like that isn't being taken into account. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
It makes it a much more difficult process, particularly for... Well, I would say both, never mind. The person that's cheating, more so the person that's been being abused, it makes it very difficult to go through the legal, the financial, the emotional, knowing that they're not getting anything extra. It's not that they're greedy. It's just, I think human nature, you've been cheated in some way. So why do you both end up with 50-50? That doesn't seem fair that that's happening. And it's true. It's not fair. I tell them all day long, it's not fair. But I practice mostly in New York State, but I practice in many other states as well. But I say New York State does not care about fair. New York State cares about equitable. There's two different things. Equitable means 50-50. It's an equitable distribution state. It's not a let's make this fair state. There aren't any let's make this fair states.
Yeah, I know.
It's harder to when a judge is involved and that story's coming out a little bit, even though it's not going to help much.
Yeah, no, but I appreciate your perspective on that because it is such a difficult thing to wrap your head around. But then with your approach, certainly financially, that being your main focus, equitable is something that can be kind of measured and planned for. Fair, how could any judge decide what is fair for what's happened in a relationship between two people that they've not been involved in? And so perhaps, you know, that is, yeah, I agree. I think I would be having the same conversations with the clients of like, I don't think it's fair either, but I don't know how we would make it fair.
And what's fair to you? And you and I could be looking, I could go through a divorce case with you. I guarantee your idea of fair would be different than my idea of fair even, right? That's such a, you can't measure fair. Everyone has something different.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like there should be a neater way to wrap up that, but I guess it's a reflection of this is the challenge. You do your best in a divorce.
There, you know what? There is a way to kind of make it fair. Get a prenup before you're married. That means you've both spelled out what the rules are and you both think it's fair.
I am very... pro prenups, and I think at times that surprises people because I'm not someone that grew up being like, marriage is one of the things I want to achieve in my life. I spent more time planning my funeral than my marriage, which maybe tells you some things about my mental health history. You know, and yet I think, you know, that it is ultimately, yes, marriage can be so brilliant for so many people and so romantic, and I love going to weddings, don't get me wrong, but there is also such legal implications. And so I personally would be on the same page as you, absolutely, that if you're going down this formalization, legalization element of your relationship, then setting some ground rules, you know, doesn't take away from it for me, you know, any more than having to like apply for a permit to get married. And that doesn't seem the most romantic thing. And yet that is also part of the process. And I guess you often hear the pushback to that is, oh, well, you know, I love this person. I plan to stay with them forever, you know, but in the same way, you can have the most wonderful car, you buy insurance for it, you can plan your dream holiday. I don't buy insurance for holidays. I'm not going to lie. It's still recommended, you know?
I don't buy insurance for them either. I'm like, I'm going no matter what. And there's never going to be a hurricane and everything's great.
Yeah, me getting injured on holiday, no, in the nice weather, that doesn't happen.
I have so much insurance for everything else, though. I have like, so I mean, some insurance I have to have. I have to have malpractice insurance. Mm-hmm. I, you know, of course, I have my health insurance. It's terrible. It doesn't cover anything, and I private pay for all of my therapists. But anywho, I could go on about that for an hour. But yeah, the disability insurance, the life insurance, vacation insurance, absolutely not. But yeah, the prenup is insurance for your marriage. And here's the other thing, though. Everything's based on the state's law, right? We went over that. The state can change their law whenever they want. So I know the law. I'm fine with the way the law is right now. I'm going to go get married. Well, maybe it's different when you get divorced. And I am not a fan of the states, the government, the feds, whatever it is, right? I'm not a fan of them telling me what to do, whether it's for marriage or this or that or religion. I'm just not a big follower of institutions that get to make the rules for me. I kind of go off on the other way. Like, I will make my own rules. And my mom said I've been like that since I was a little girl. But anyway, make your own rules. Just make your own rules. Get the insurance, make your own rules, right?
I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I think a lot of people, whether it's America and Trump or, you know, any country and the widely different opinions on different politicians, the idea of either the person that you support or the person you really don't having a potential distant hand in how your marriage might end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm like such a lover. Like, I think marriage is great. When I love, I love. I have one tattoo. It says, love hard when there's love to be had. It's the only tattoo I have. It's the only tattoo I'll probably ever have. But I love love. I love marriage. I do. Just because I'm the divorce queen doesn't mean that I don't. I just find that if you're not it's just if you're not happy in a relationship, then I want to help you out of it.
Yes.
One. And the first one you're going to get into, going back to a question from a long time ago after we got on our tangents, the first one you're going to get into that's beautiful after the divorce is one with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, totally agree. We might have to get you back on Dating Games because I think we see eye to eye on so much of this stuff. I love your perspective. And I love that with the work you do, you've not allowed it to make you jaded because it would be so understandable to happen. And I promised that we would wrap up with some of the positives. So could you share a little bit of what you see when you do get to work with clients and they do get the emotional support, they do get the legal support, they have you in their life, and I think they're very lucky for it. And, you know, what's the impact you see then when the support is there and when the divorce finally goes through?
So what's really cool is because I can see it with like the 10,000 foot view, sometimes I'll see them once a week. Sometimes I won't see them for a month or two because we're waiting on things. I can see this woman abused, not abused, come to me. She's unsure. They say so many times, whether they're a doctor or a stay-at-home mom, they feel stupid. They feel stupid that it's happening. They feel stupid that they let it happen. They feel stupid they don't know enough, whatever it may be. They have shame. Many have guilt. I'm breaking up the family if they're the ones initiating. And what happens is with that support of their therapist, of me, we begin building them up. We build up their heart, their soul, their character. Part of that, though, is by educating them, too. I educate them on things here and there. I said, you know, throughout all of this, I'm going to be doing things and explaining them to you, which an attorney can do, too. But I'm going to educate you, and I'm just going to sprinkle it here and there because I want you to have lifelong tools. I don't want you to just say, okay, sounds good. Okay, sounds good. I want you to have, you know, vested decisions. These are your decisions. I will support you either way as long as you understand what's happening and why you're choosing something. That's a big difference between me and an attorney. It's not, oh, you'll be fine. Here, sign here. I want them to understand. So very slowly, the shame, this guilt, this I don't know anything is, okay, I get this now. I understand it. I remember you saying that. My therapist and I had a great session last night, and I view how what we're going to do with the, you know, the kids afterwards for joint custody this way now. So it's bits and pieces from the different professionals that very slowly build them up. And sometimes they realize it's happening. Sometimes they don't get it until it's like the very end. And they see, you know, this is me now compared to this was me the first time. But what I get to see is every step of the way, just very slowly blossoming. They feel secure. They know they're going to be okay. They know that they're going to have enough money for their children. And that empowerment comes from the education, I think. And from not feeling helpless. They can do the bills. They know how they work. They understand how the 401k works. They're fine. They are independent. I get them to independence and security.
I love that. And the listeners can't see you, so they don't know you've been beaming the whole time describing that. And I think if you're going through divorce, get yourself a divorce team that is this excited about the person you'll be after and about the divorce process, because it is scary. It's a lot to consider. And, you know, I know something you often educate people on in the kind of decision-making process of building your team is not only these different elements of who you should be working with, like we've discussed, but also this isn't something to scrimp on. You want, you know, financial security as much as possible is a big part of this. And therefore, going with someone that really knows their stuff, even if the cost is more in the short term, they're also an expert at figuring out how you can pay for that best. And so I love the work you do. And thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Always happy to share.
Thank you. And so if people want to check out your work, get more of your kind of general insights, or even, you know, live in the States like many of our listeners do and might want to work with you, where should they go?
The best place to find me, understand what I do, and contact me for a 30-minute complimentary consultation is supportivedivorcesolutions.com.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And we will wrap up there, unless there was anything else you wanted to say.
That was fun.
Cool. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.